DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Hello, I'm Irene Quayle in Bonn. Thanks for joining us as we send out an SOS for some of the world's rarest creatures in South America.
When it's asleep, it looks like some green county floss. And when it's awake, it's got lime green skin with orange eyes with black patterns on them and orange feet.
And way down in New Zealand.
She's just roosting at the base of that kamahi.
Oh, okay.
And I just saw a flash of feathers. And then she was bolting.
And we find out why so many of our species are under threat and what we can do about it.
Sometimes they disguise it in Nescafe tins, you know, like coffee, and or drinking chocolate, or even wrap it in cigarette packets. That's what they do. The dogs sniff through that.
Coming up on this edition of Living Planet. First, we turn to a very rare and exotic creature found only at the southernmost tip of New Zealand. Conservationists have spent the last months working day and night to save the world's heaviest and strangest parrot, the kakapo. There are only 123 birds left in the world. The word kakapo means parrot of the night in the indigenous Maori language, but its nocturnal habit is just one of the bird's unusual characteristics. Like many other birds in New Zealand, the kakapo has lost its ability to fly. It has a sweet, musty smell, and it breeds only every few years. This year, these peculiar parrots are having an excellent breeding season with a record number of 36 chicks. Each of them is about to have its genome sequenced in an ambitious research project to understand the infertility rates and diseases which have driven the birds to the brink of extinction. Veronica Meduna joined a team of scientists working on Codfish Island, a predator-free sanctuary island where kakapo still thrive.
Welcome to the quarantine store. We're going to get you guys all prepped to go over to Whenua. So we'll go through, get your stuff clean, and then we'll do a safety briefing down the front before heading out to the airport.
Whenua Hole, or Codfish Island, is one of three offshore islands where kakapo survive thanks to a complete lack of mammalian predators. To visit the island means to undergo strict quarantine checks before and after takeoff.
Hey. Hi.
Hello, and welcome to Whenua Hole Hut.
Hello.
So we're just at the next stage of our quarantine now. And we'll just be opening up all our bags, just rummaging through the first half, checking all the fish bins. We just want to make sure that no creepy crawlies or mice or any other sort of rodents have managed to sneak in since we've taken it all from our I Street quarantine area. So if we start that now, and we just want to keep all the doors and windows shut until we're completely finished this procedure.
Right. Yep, good.
As soon as every pocket, zip and Velcro is thoroughly checked, I'm off to catch a kakapo with Deirdre Virko, who manages the Department of Conservation's Kakapo Recovery Project, and kakapo conservation scientist Andrew Digby.
So we're after Huhana today. She's a seven-year-old female, and we're just standing up here at the start of Rimu Track, and we're just going to get a little indication of where she is. So I'm using a radio telemetry device. It's got a receiver and an aerial, and we key that into her particular frequency. So she's channel 53.
So she'd be wearing a transmitter
at all times. All kakapo wear a backpack transmitter, so a small transmitter on their back, to enable us to track them using this telemetry gear. So I'm just turned it on, and I'm just swinging the aerial to try and see if I can get a signal from her. And if we get a signal, we should hear a beep. I can't hear a beep at the moment, so we're probably too far away. So we'll head a little bit closer towards where we know her home range is and try and check from a little bit closer. Okay, so we're getting quite close to where Huhana is now. We're probably within about 50 metres or so. And as we go in closer, we just have to be a bit careful about where we're putting our feet. So they'll often hide under vegetation or under logs. and we should always make sure that we put our feet where we can see where we're placing them so we don't accidentally tread on her. Their response to predators can often be just to freeze, and so they can often just stay put even when you're very close. And kakapo are extremely well camouflaged, especially in the sort of bush we are in now, and so you can be within a couple of metres of a kakapo and really not see it.
If she runs directly towards you and not to one of us, feel free to help us by capturing her. And the best way to do that is just to really lightly put a hand on her back. Don't push down, but just lightly hold her still on the back, and she'll probably stop at that point. And then you want to get your hand just around the back of her head so you can control the bitey bit. But we'll be right behind you to help with that, just in case she does come directly to you. She's just roosting at the base of that kaumahi.
Oh, okay.
And I just saw a flash of feathers, and then she was bolting.
Some kakapo are noisy and some aren't. So we just do a health check. Now checking the eyes, checking the ears.
In their effort to bring the kakapo back from the brink of extinction, scientists are using every technology available to conservation. Each bird carries a transmitter, and remote sensing techniques are employed to track movement around each nest site. The kakapo's sex life is arguably the most closely monitored of any endangered species, with sperm tests, artificial insemination, and now genome sequencing to work out why infertility is such a big issue. Kakapo don't exactly help themselves. They are the only parrot in the world with a lek mating ritual, in which the males dig a pit and just sit there, booming, in the hope that a female might consider them attractive enough. What's more, they only breed when a particular native tree, the rimu, produces a lot of fruit, and that only happens every 2 to 4 years. While adult kakapo do just fine without the rimu fruit, it seems an essential ingredient in the chick's diet.
So we've just caught Huhana and got blood samples from her, which we're going to use for our vitamin D study. We've learned in the past that kakapo have got very low levels of vitamin D, but we've only had a few samples. And what we're doing now is doing a more concerted effort to understand more about vitamin D in kakapo, because the levels are extremely low compared to most other bird species. If they had the levels that kakapo have, then they would be sick.
So does vitamin D play the same or similar role as in humans?
Well, we don't know, but we think so. Vitamin D in wild bird species, has been extremely poorly studied, so we just don't really know. We assume it's got the similar implications for health and for fertility that it does for humans. So low vitamin D levels have been associated with a wide range of health problems and also with low fertility.
Coffee space receiving, go ahead.
Hey Jen, just got to wait for Nora 1, over.
Cool, go ahead please.
Okay, so the chick is 1200 grams exactly, 1200 grams, with an almost empty crop, over.
1200 grams with an empty crop. Stand by, I'll put that in the
computer. Kakapo evolved for millions of years without any mammals. The plump parrots were once plentiful throughout New Zealand, but their downfall began when people arrived some 700 years ago, and with them an entourage of rats, cats and stoats. In the 1970s, the kakapo was thought to be extinct, but two remaining populations were discovered, with one in Fiordland including only males. The challenge now is to give these strange, sweet-smelling birds a helping hand so that the Fiordland genes remain in the gene pool.
So most of our kakapo, practically all of them, came from Rakiuru, Stewart Island. One came from Fiordland, and Sinbad is the son of that last Fiordland bird, Richard Henry. Sinbad has a brother and a sister, Gulliver and Kuia, so they're all very precious birds.
Is the reason for doing or for going as far as you are with artificial insemination and now genomics, is the reason trying to increase the genetic diversity or bringing those Fiordland genes back into the gene pool?
Well, you can never increase genetic diversity, you can only decrease the amount of loss, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to slow down that loss of genetic diversity, and in particular to try and maintain those Fiordland genes.
It has been the biggest season so far, definitely in terms of effort on the bird's part. We've had two big seasons in 2002 and 2009, and in those years we had 24 and then 33 chicks fledge. At the moment, we've got 36 chicks, so we're hoping all 36 will fledge, although we still have a bit of time ahead of us before we reach that milestone.
How big do you think the population would need to be for you to be able to just leave them to it?
We'd really like to get to the point where we have three self-managing populations, possibly in excess of 500 birds, and it's important to look at that, the health of the population. When we started this program, we had 51 old birds. We had no idea how old they were. It's possible that they were on death's door. Now we have 123 and quite a large proportion of young birds with a long lifespan ahead of them. So we're on the right track.
Veronica Maduna, DW, Codfish Island, New Zealand.
Unlike the land-bound kakapo, migratory birds fly millions of miles on a regular basis between their breeding grounds and their winter quarters. BirdLife International estimates that at least 25 million of them, including endangered species of waterfowl, songbirds and raptors, are killed illegally every year around the Mediterranean Sea alone. Close to our Deutsche Welle studios here in Bonn is the headquarters of the United Nations Convention on Migratory Species, or CMS for short. It recently announced the creation of a special intergovernmental task force to combat the illegal killing, taking and trade of migratory birds in the Mediterranean area. Carmen Navis is the coordinator. She dropped into the studio earlier and I asked her who makes up the task force and how they plan to catch the villains who are killing our feathered friends.
It's composed mainly by government officials, a representative from each of the coastal countries in the Mediterranean, and also a number of observers, which are international organizations, NGOs, United Nations agencies, etc. Basically, it will focus on law enforcement. It will provide the means for the countries to tackle the illegal killing in their own countries.
So why are birds being killed and which birds in particular are we talking about?
Well, there are a number of species affected. These are migratory birds which migrate in particularly in autumn and spring. In autumn, they migrate from Europe to Africa and then in spring, they travel back to Europe in order to breed. So, according to a study from BirdLife International, an estimated number of 25 million migratory birds are killed every year.
That's a lot of birds.
Yes, indeed. And it's only an estimation, a modest estimation.
Now, are we talking about birds being deliberately killed or birds which are killed because they hit power lines or are involved in some kind of accidents?
No, we are talking about deliberate killing. So it means a deliberate illegal action that goes against international legislation.
So what kind of killing? Are we talking about people who hunt birds or farmers who kill birds?
Yes, we are talking about different methods that are used in this region in particular, which include the trapping with mist nets. These are nets that are placed right in the coast, right next to the sea. The birds are not able to view these nets, so they are trapped in them. And therefore, it's a way of catching a high number of birds in an easy way. So they are trapped in these nets and they normally die very slowly and painfully. And there is also a gluing system. It's a type of glue that they take it from the trees. But then they spread it into the branches of the trees so that birds get trapped. So again, it's a very painful way of killing. They are also shot.
So why are people doing this?
There are several reasons for them to do it. There is a commercial purpose and there is a subsistence reason, either for food or it's just when they have a very low income, they normally use the illegal trade or the illegal killing or trapping to sell the birds. This is the case of cage birds, for example. They are trapped in order to be sold as cage birds. And there is also a cultural reason for them to hunt. This has been a very traditional practice for centuries. In many countries in the region, it becomes like a sport for them.
This sort of hunting has been taking place for a long time. You said it is part of a cultural tradition. Have things changed to make it more of a problem these days, or are we just finding out about it now?
Well, the thing is that right now, this review of the illegal killing that I just mentioned before, that is a very comprehensive study, the first comprehensive study which measures the scope and the scale of the illegal killing, taking and trade of birds in the region.
Now, if we come back to the task force itself, apart from the people who are looking at the legal aspects, the actual volunteers who go out there checking up, trying to catch these people, how does it work?
This includes to strengthen the action from the police forces. We need an urgent action at the moment because of these high numbers of migratory birds that are being killed every year. The task force will also help the training of judges and police officers. So this is also something important to increase the penalties.
Can you give me an example of a species which will be focused on and where we might see some success in the not too distant future?
Well, a case of a species that are affected by the illegal killing is, for example, songbirds. Songbirds are very small birds that are migratory birds, obviously. Protected by the Convention on Migratory Species, and these songbirds are trapped in order to be cage birds for, you know, to just to have them in the houses and enjoy their singing. So in the Mediterranean region, high numbers of songbirds die in the process of the illegal trade, so they are particularly affected by this problem.
Then I hope we'll be able to hear you on Living Planet sometime in the not-too-distant future telling us about some of the successes in saving our popular birds.
I hope so.
Carmen Navis, who's heading up the new task force to save our migratory birds. It's not just birds who are under threat from illegal hunting and trade. This week, the European Union approved a series of measures to tackle a surge in illegal wildlife trade. A 5-year plan aims to define illegal wildlife trafficking as a serious crime for the first time ever. At the moment, it's one of the world's most lucrative criminal activities, ranking fourth globally in terms of monetary value behind trafficking in drugs, trafficking in people and counterfeiting. Elephants are amongst the best-known victims, slaughtered for their ivory tusks. Customs officials in the African country of Kenya have brought in their own 4-legged task force to sniff out ivory being smuggled in luggage through Nairobi International Airport. Our correspondent and friends have been on the scent.
At Nairobi's International Airport, Asha excitedly jumps onto the baggage conveyor belt. With lightning speed, the small, black and white, long-eared Springer Spaniel runs from bag to bag, sniffing eagerly. Suddenly, the dog stops. She sits down next to an ordinary green canvas backpack. Inside the bag is the tip of an elephant tusk. It's not even the size of a human hand. This exercise is a piece of cake for Asha.
Sometimes he disguises it in Nescafe tins, you know, like coffee. And or drinking chocolate, or even wrap it in cigarette packets. So that's what they do. The dog sniff through that.
That's Mark Kinyua. He's responsible for the dog squad at Kenya Wildlife Service. His dogs are part of an anti-poaching unit established to track and capture poachers in national parks. And the dogs help search for contraband goods at airports and seaports. With success. This year alone, Asha and her 4-legged colleagues have helped arrest 21 smugglers. Inside normal-looking suitcases, the dogs have found all kinds of items, from ivory bracelets to pearls and furs to rhino horn.
We've had an arrest of raw ivory in the cargo area. So we were tipped off about this information and we were called in to retrieve. And we retrieved 64.12 kilograms from Mozambique headed to Bangkok.
In Asia, particularly in China, Vietnam and Thailand, the demand for smuggled ivory is huge. The Kenya Wildlife Service knows that and acts accordingly.
Now, we can't cover all the luggage that comes through. What we can do, though, is have specific countries that we zoom into.
In Kenya, those who get caught with ivory can expect a hefty fine. One of the smugglers caught this year was sentenced to 5 years behind bars for having jewelry made out of ivory that weighed only 150 grams. That's 5.3 ounces. The others had to pay a combined fine of 240,000 euros. But that won't scare away the poaching and smuggling rings, says the head of Kenya Wildlife Service, Richard Leakey.
The poaching situation in East Africa has continued to go from bad to worse, and Tanzania, in the last 3 years, lost 30,000 or 40,000 animals.
During this time, roughly 100,000 elephants were killed on the entire continent. In order to protect those elephants that still remain, Kenya Wildlife Service isn't just searching for contraband. They want to extinguish the entire ivory trade and declare it illegal, without exceptions. That means no selling of confiscated tusks, no hunting trophies, and no export of old stock. In early May, Kenya staged the largest burning of ivory in history in order to send a clear message to potential buyers all over the world, says Leakey.
Let us make a very strong statement. This stuff is worthless rubbish.
And Sophie Brendlin presented that report, fired by correspondent Linda Staude from Nairobi. Around 200 different frog species have disappeared in recent decades, and many more are critically endangered. Habitat loss is one of the key factors, especially in South America, where rainforest has been cut down for agricultural plantations or other purposes. Another is the chytrid fungus, which is infecting frogs on a global scale. Conservationists are fighting hard to save more of the amphibians from extinction. One of them is a 10-year-old girl from England. She's trying to protect the lemur leaf frog. Lars Bevangar reports.
Yeah, so the lemur leaf frog, they like to sit underneath leaves. So we give them these potted plants, which are like rubber plants with these big, big, broad leaves. Right. So you can see they're quite a small frog.
Wow, is that thing his eyes?
Yeah, so when you wake them up, they have these large, very enigmatic eyes with a vertical pupil.
Frog expert Adam Bland at the Manchester Museum is holding something very rare in his hand. The lemur leaf frog is critically endangered. In the wild, it only lives in one small place, in Costa Rica, in Central America.
It's bright green during the day, but during the night time, when they're active, they actually go kind of like a chocolate brown colour and sometimes almost red.
The lemur leaf frog is tiny. It's about the size of your thumb. But like all amphibians, it is an important part of the ecosystem in the rainforest where it lives.
In the tropics, there's more amphibians almost than any other kind of animal, and they're eating insects. So if you lose the amphibians, a lot of other animals are going to have a huge effect, you know. And lots of these little amphibians are feeding on mosquitoes, which can also spread diseases in humans as well.
Hi, my name is Lucy. I'm 10 years old and I love frogs.
Luckily, the plight of the lemur leaf frog is now getting noticed by the future generation, much thanks to Manchester schoolgirl Lucy Marland.
Well, the first time I saw these really interesting frogs was at the Manchester Museum, and that's where it all started 2 years ago. There's a long story to it. I was just sort of amazed at his eyes, like the tiger stripes and the patterns. And when it's asleep, it looks like some green county floss. And when it's awake, it's got lime green skin with orange eyes with black patterns on them and orange feet.
They live in the rainforest high in the mountains of Costa Rica, a very long way from Manchester. In the wild, they are almost impossible to find.
Lucy is now fronting a global campaign on behalf of Manchester Museum and the lemur leaf frog called Learning with Lucy. It aims to educate school children in the UK, in Costa Rica and elsewhere.
Watch the next episode to find out more about how you can help. Because after all, it all starts with you.
Can you tell me a little bit what you do as a frog ambassador?
Well, what we've done is we've had lots of interviews, we've done a few films and other things like that.
And we've also got an educational pack for kids around my own age, which will help their understanding in frogs.
So what is it that this frog needs help with? What's threatening it?
Well, it's the chytrid fungus that is decreasing it the most, but other things such as deforestation and other things like that are also decreasing the numbers.
How important do you think it is that you, a 10-year-old girl from Manchester, is talking about this to people around the world, really?
Well, it shows you that you don't have to be an adult to head campaigns and show people what we should be doing. Children of all ages could also help some of the world's most endangered creatures. It's not only adults that are important, you have to have children to, like, inspire other children.
So I'm here in the Costa Rican Amphibian Research Centre. I've just had my first experience trekking through the rainforest, and it was just so much better to be able to see them in the natural habitat.
I'm not great with, like, dark and creepy crawlies, but when you see the frogs, you just forget everything else. The colours are spectacular. I can't even describe how amazing it was to see them in the wild.
As part of the programme to save the Lima leaf frog, students of biology and zoology from the University of Manchester are given the chance to travel to Costa Rica and experience the wildlife for themselves.
I'm Professor Amanda Bamford. I'm Associate Dean in the Faculty of Life Sciences here at the University of Manchester. I thought it would be really brilliant if we enable students to go out to Costa Rica and actually see them in the wild. So every year in June, we take about 25 students out to Costa Rica.
As part of the Learning with Lucy programme, this year students will also go to Sweden to work with Europe's largest conservation programme at the Nordens Ark Foundation, explains Professor Amanda Bamford.
They'll go out to places like Nordens Ark with their lima leaf frogs and work with the local school children and involve them in activities coming into Nordens Ark and learning about the lima leaf frog. As part of that, we're also doing the same project here with the Manchester primary schools.
And how important would you say it is to actually involve school-aged children in conservation issues like this one?
It's absolutely vital. We have a tagline here at the museum called "It's All About You." So it's what we do as individuals can really make a difference in the world.
Can show Lars your what you got off David Attenborough.
Oh wow.
Well, it's like David Attenborough holding the frog in one of his films, I think.
Back at Lucy's house, her mother urges her to show me a rather special message of support from one of the world's most famous naturalists, Sir David Attenborough. It is a picture of Sir David holding a lima leaf frog with a special message to Lucy herself.
It says, "I wholeheartedly support Manchester Museum's campaign, heading by Lucy Marlin to save the lima leaf frog. It is, after all, one of the world's most unusual and rarest amphibians, and it is in real trouble. Best wishes, David."
And that says, "Best wishes, David," in his own handwriting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty special. Not many people have that.
No.
What are you going to be when you grow up?
Zoologist.
Zoologist.
Mm-hmm.
Lucy's greatest wish right now is to be able to travel to Costa Rica and see the lima leaf frog in its natural habitat. But for now, she'll continue campaigning for the rare amphibian from England. Lars Bevanger, DW, Manchester.
And that's it from Living Planet for this week. If you enjoyed the programme, you can download episodes or replay them online at dw.com/environment, where you can also read up on some other environment stories in and behind the news. You can also listen to DW Living Planet stories on iTunes and on SoundCloud. And we'll be delighted to hear your thoughts and comments on the programme and the environmental issues that concern you. You can reach us by email to livingplanet@dw.com or via Twitter to DW_eco. I'm Irene Quayle. From all of us here in Bonn, studio producer Eunice Wanjiru and sound engineer Steffi Brown, until next time, thanks for listening and bye for now.